Now that I am wearing my own eyebrows, we may start.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Neil Almond.
Hello, good to be here.
And Shannon Doherty.
Hi, Happy New Year!
Happy New Year indeed. And to kick off the new year, I'm going to throw some unseen questions your way. But first, Neil, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
It's part of a super secret project, which I don't think is becoming that super or secret anymore. I've been reading all about effective pencil grasps or grips, as we might want to call them over here. That's a kind of an interesting part of the literature, in that the way that a person holds a pencil, and it seems a lot of the American literature, they go with the word grasp instead of grip. But effectively, it's to just look deeply into the situation as to whether actually does it matter what kind of grip kids use to handwrite with. And basically, whilst we were probably told while we were kids and probably told to teach, you know, that kind of the classic tripod, research evidence seems to suggest that actually, well, that's necessarily the best one, but there are other grips out there that you can use. And so this kind of research is kind of categorize them into two sort of groups, those that are mature and that those that are what they call immature grasps. And effectively, as long as the grip that children are using fall into that mature grip, then it doesn't really make any difference to the legibility of children's handwriting, which is obviously quite an interesting thing to do, because a lot of my early experience with teaching handwriting was, if you saw kids not doing the classic tripod, then you need to sort of correct them. And that's the kind of the first point of call. Seems not to be the case, which I think is quite interesting. The other side of it is what's been quite interesting for reading about this project is that it's taken me down into lots of sort of occupational sort of health and therapy sort of side of research, not just sort of educational research. So I'm transdisciplinarian right now, which I'm kind of enjoying a little bit. What about you, Shannon? What are you reading for?
Thank you for asking. I am reading a paper. So it's a research paper written by one of our teachers in our trust. She actually is a year six teacher in the school that I teach in for half the week. And it appeared in the International Journal of Multidisciplinary Comparative Studies earlier on this year. And the title of it is, What are teacher and pupil experiences of reading aloud for pleasure in the year six classroom? Her name is Kirstine Balkwill. So it's part of her master's. And we did our PGCs together, actually. So we've known each other for a long time. And I was so pleased when this got published, because I know that she, you know, it's something she worked really hard on. It's very well written. So it's all about the benefits of reading aloud to children. So it talks about the fact that much of the research focuses on the cognitive or academic benefits, and less about the emotional side or the effect on like the children's well-being. And it features pupil interviews, teacher interviews. There's, you know, she's had conversations with year six teachers from a range of schools. And it's worth a read, I'd say. One, because I have got to rep one of my own teachers writing a research paper, but also because I thought it was just a really interesting read. And I sent it to our primary head of English as well for our trust to feature in his upcoming literacy newsletter. So I think it's a good read, and I definitely recommend you read it. So I'll say the name again one more time. What are teacher and pupil experiences of reading aloud for pleasure in the year six classroom? What about you, Kieran? What are you reading for?
Excellent. Will you link it?
Yes, I will. I will tweet it.
Fantastic. Thank you. Now, Neil, I actually had a bump on my finger most of the way through secondary school, and it hasn't ever really gone away from writing. Any of the research suggests that I was holding my pen wrong, or is that just something everybody gets because they're writing like mad the whole way through Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4?
How were you holding your pen?
With my right hand.
With your right hand. Oh, okay. It would probably depend on how you were holding it, but I would imagine that a bit of a probably appears regardless.
I've got a slight. I'm trying to compare my right and my left middle fingers. There's definitely a little bump.
So there you go. The weirdest thing, not from this research, but related to, is that I saw a whole thread of how Taylor Swift holds a pen on Twitter.
No guesses as to why he was interested in that.
And the way that Taylor Swift holds her pen is bizarre. Just going to leave that out there.
It looks normal, doesn't it? It does rest on my finger.
That will be why. It's the rest.
Yeah,
there.
Rests on mine as well.
Oh, so it should be like that, like I'm holding chopsticks?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's the classic tripod, but...
But this research...
Well, I'd have to look at it again to work out if Kieran is holding it in a mature way or immature way.
I mean, it works. The pen works. But yeah, I could have avoided deforming my finger because my left hand is fine. Yeah, I mean, people didn't need to know this, but I just thought it was really interesting.
Maybe everyone should send in a picture of them holding a pen or a pencil so that you could then say whether it's mature.
Or immature. And I guess now, Kieran, actually, you can apply for some funding for like a longitudinal study about how pencil grip affects on the writing hand, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the line.
Worth it.
The word sounds horrible. I mean, I'm in two minds whether to keep this in or not because of that terminology. We shall see. Maybe I'll just bleep out the word.
People can use their imagination.
But much lower this time, because I think the last one was quite loud. I don't know if you guys have listened to the episode where Shannon swore.
No.
No? Well, I bleeped it out with the Metal Gear Solid alert.
Well, no, it wasn't a bad swear, though, was it?
Yeah, but it would affect his explicit rating.
Not the C-bomb.
What was it?
No, but, I mean, go back. Episode 156, I think, maybe it was?
Yeah, I remember doing it.
Oh. So... I have been reading a paper called Computer Programming in Primary Schools, Swedish Technology Teachers' Pedagogical Strategies, and it's by Bjursten, Nilsson, and Gernelius. And essentially, if you want to think deeply about pedagogical strategies that you might use during computing lessons, then this paper is a really good outline. I mean, basically, it comes to the conclusion that Swedish teachers, having now been expected to teach computer programming, have as much background knowledge and prerequisite knowledge as English teachers did when we were told we had to teach computer programming, computer science. And so they're trying to make sense of what are the best, or even just to get people to think about pedagogical strategies. And it outlines five that were identified in 2017, and then three more strategies that came from this study, I think. So, yeah, so worth checking out.
Very little niche bit of research, that, isn't it?
Very niche. And I'm really sorry that Neil was drinking one of your son's fruit shoots.
Is that why he was laughing?
They're nice. And the J2Os. I've seen the J2Os off as
yeah,
well.
He's had Oscar's J2Os and now Dylan's fruit shoots.
Fair play. I do the same thing myself.
Absolutely. They're taking up valuable fridge space.
I've got some unseen questions. The first one came through email. It says, we were debating earlier in school, teachers, not pupils, whether cursive should be used on all displays and printed materials that pupils see. My suspicion is that it does at best make little positive difference, and at worst can be an unhelpful misrepresentation of text in the outside world. I'd be interested to hear any thoughts you guys had on this matter.
I believe whoever sent this in, their initial sort of reaction is probably about right, I would have thought. I can't think that it makes any difference at all what font, or whether it's whether it's cursive or not, will make a difference to children's handwriting whatsoever. In fact, actually, a little bit of research, again, for not so super secret project, looked at putting children who just looked at sort of letters and letter formations, and those children who did look to the letter formations and, you know, visually traced over them, those that kind of visually traced over those words and could see the letters rather did far better. So, and the kids who just saw the letters didn't really get any better at just writing the letters. So if you're kind of hoping that it just kind of will solve that problem, research, although, you know, it's far from conclusive, but what is out there, what I've read from it so far, seems to suggest it's not really going to make much of a difference. There's a workload issue within that as well, in terms of making sure that, you know, you go and select the right font all the time after you've written something up. Or perhaps if you're more, your school's a bit more draconian, perhaps they ask you to handwrite things themselves to make sure that they follow the school's policy. And I've worked in a school that had something like that. I think it was actually during my placement time. So thankfully, I only had to pretend I had really good handwriting for about 6 weeks.
Yes, because you do not have really good handwriting.
No, I don't.
Interesting little research nugget there. I enjoyed that. I would come from the workload point of view, that I think it should come down to what the teacher thinks is best or what works best for them. As long as things are legible and neat, like neat in whatever way is going to be accessed by the children, as long as they can read it from wherever they sit, if it has, you know, if it needs to be read, if it doesn't need to be read, why is it on the wall? Then I think handwrite it, type it, put it in Comic Sans, put it in a Zazzy font, whatever you want to do, whatever you choose, because you are the teacher and you know those children and it's your classroom. And I just think sometimes people like making policies for policy's sake. And I don't think having everything cursive or having everything handwritten has a great deal of impact. I mean, we've seen people before, haven't we, kind of ask on Twitter what the impact of working walls are on children's progress. We're going even further down into the niche research if we start asking about the whether or not handwriting or writing on displays is cursive or not. I don't think it's necessary. I think if you like handwriting things, handwrite it and whack it up. If you like typing things, type it and print it. I do a mixture of both. If it's like vocab, then I tend to put it on like a sentence strip, snip it and then staple it up and I handwrite that. If it's something that I am planning on having up for a bit longer, then I'll type it. But I think it needs to come down to teacher judgment. And I can't see it having that much of a positive impact. It also, you know, they're not expected to write in cursive past the end of Key Stage 2, are they? They're just expected to be able to print. So it seems silly to spend all our time on that and all of our efforts on that when there are better things to be doing with our time.
I mean, do you think inspiring handwriting is the reason? Is that the reason why people do this? Are there any other possible reasons?
I imagine high expectations probably is a reason why a school leader may want to put something like that into play. So, you know, we have high expectations, so we expect the writing that you do to reflect the writing that you would expect the kids to do. And, you know, it's on show, so it has to look your best. But I don't necessarily buy that argument that that's a good thing to do, because kids don't tend not to look at the working walls or that kind of stuff anyway. Obviously, the only exception to this, I would probably argue, I could understand why a leader would want this, is obviously your own sort of handwriting display. So if they're a cursive is what your school is, what your leaders are saying that you need to teach, then obviously if you have a handwriting display, so perhaps like year two, year three, maybe a bit of year four, where they tend to kind of perhaps learn that cursive in a bit more depth, then that's probably a good thing to have. And if you have a semi-permanent display, and by that I mean something that you're probably going to change, you know, maybe only just like once, perhaps a term, maybe even bi-termly, or not bi-termly, but maybe like once every two terms, maybe then there's a argument to have it. If it's in your corridors, maybe, but certainly in the classroom, just do whatever you need to do.
I think the only other thing I would say is that if you are modeling writing, then, and you're handwriting that, then I think writing that neatly and within the policy, because you're expecting children to look at that model, makes sense. But I wouldn't sit there if I were doing a learning wall and saw that someone hadn't join something like our policy says, I'm not going to get het up about it. I just think, you know, you make an effort to make it look neat and accessible for the children, whichever way that is.
Nice handwriting is a proxy for greater depth writing overall. So I say we double down and let's go for cursive font on internal emails as well.
Nice.
Maybe external ones in the future. With that one put to bed, I think. The next one, I think it deserves a couple of episodes. And I've said to the person that we will talk about this on this episode, but I would also try and find teachers who worked in this situation and were successful. It says, I would love to have a Tadapi episode on mixed age classes, curriculum planning and or assessment. I mean, there's a series in itself. I have recently joined a Federation of Small Schools and the organization and curriculum for mixed age classes has literally blown my mind. But I have so many questions. It's surprising how many teachers work in mixed age classes across the country, yet discussions around primary teaching, pedagogy and discourse largely ignore the needs of schools whose classes are organized in ways other than single year groupings. And so I thought I'd put this to you guys just to see if you had any thoughts on how best to approach teaching in a school with mixed age classes. And obviously we heard very recently about a class that had year R and year five.
Yeah.
In it. And I've recently been working with someone who had a year 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in their class. So there are some really, I don't know, I don't know if challenging is the right word, because I'm sure it can be really rewarding too. But having 1 year group is much easier than having mixed year groups in your class, hands down. What advice have you guys got for anybody based on your experience working with schools in that situation?
I've never worked in a school with mixed age classes. However, we do have one in our trust, and I am a governor at a little federation that has a small school with mixed age classes in it. So I have a little bit to say. My first thing I would say is you're a hero for taking that on, because I do think it is more challenging to have more than 1 year group in a class. You know, it's challenging enough to have, what, I've got 32 year threes. And my job share and I are trying to meet the needs of that range of 32 in a year three class. And I'm sure if you've got a 3-4 or a 2-3-4 or bigger, then your range is obviously going to be even more spread apart. And so just the fact that you're doing that and that you're teaching those children and that you're seeking support and advice shows that you want to do the absolute best for them. So you're a hero and we salute you. I know that the school that is in my trust that has currently got a reception 1-2, a 3-4 and a 5-6 class. Up until this academic year, they were doing sort of like a specialist model for the last few years, where they had one teacher teaching all the maths, one doing the reading and writing. The earliest teacher taught the phonics across the classes, and there was another teacher who did all the rest, and that seemed to work well for them. But you know, as things fluctuate and change, it's not necessarily a sustainable model, because they did have a reception and a 1-2 class. Now they've got a reception 1-2 class, and as staff come and go, it's probably not necessarily sustainable, because you're not always going to find someone who wants to teach all of the foundation subjects or all of the maths, although that bit did sound like heaven. And now it's a case of going back to having one teacher per class, and they, you know, they have a rolling cycle curriculum, as I think most mixed age classes do. You know, if you've got 2 year groups in one class, you'll have a 2 year cycle. If you've got three, then you'll have a 3 year cycle. That seems to be the norm for mixed age classes. And then the school where I'm a governor, they have, they follow White Rose. They use the White Rose booklets at the moment, and their teachers do a split input. So they will do a year three input, say, for maths, and then a year four input for maths, so that they're not having to cross over those two units of work. I know in some places it does work out that, you know, you're all doing the place value at the same time, you're all doing addition and subtraction, but at some point it does start to veer off, and keeping everyone on the same area isn't necessarily what's best for them. It might be what's best for them though. So I think being flexible with your planning, think flexible with your thought process. I don't think there is a one size fits all. Obviously there's not, because you've talked about that, the one that we saw in a Facebook group that had reception and year five in the same class, and nothing in between. And you know, you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in one class. That's very different to just having a year three and four class, or having a 1, 2, where your curricula are sort of more closely aligned. I don't think there's like a quick win or a silver bullet for a mixed age situation. I think you just have to do whatever works for you and be prepared to be flexible, because it might work one year, it might not work the next. I think that, I think as long as you are putting as much thought and effort into it as you seem to be by reaching out to other people, then you're on the right track. We're all going into this, I think, with the best of intentions. And so just keep doing what you think is working. Obviously, if you've rocked up to a small school for the first time and it's blown your mind, it might just be because you didn't realize they existed, or that that's how they worked, or it might be that they're doing something really wacky and you want to get other experiences, which is why I think episodes on mixed age planning and curriculum would be really good, and I would look forward to listening to those. But other than that, I just think you're doing your best, and that's the main thing.
I do wonder if there's a bit of a trade-off, and I mean it's like nationally, in terms of number of pupils in class versus mixed age, which might obviously help make the whole situation a little bit easier. Obviously, if you've got a class of 20 between 3 and 4 as a class of 30, just a single year group. And obviously, if you've got reception 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then it's probably unlikely that you have 30 kids in that class. It's probably still only about 6 or 7, maybe. I don't know. Depends on the school. But it'd be interesting to see.
It
would be interesting to see, really see if there is a correlation between class size versus amount of split year groups in one class.
Well, I can tell you the school where I'm a governor has got full classes. So they have 30 in the 1, 2. And I think they have 32 in the 3, 4 and 32 in the 5, 6. And they're just always full. But you're definitely right that sometimes there are smaller numbers, aren't there? Which is why there's not one way of doing it, because every small school is different.
I do think perhaps a rule of thumb is that the greater the age range, the more likely it is that a split input is probably going to work best for you. I can't see how you could possibly try and do maths when you have reception to 5, for example, in one sort of input. But that could be me, because I went to a school, and when I was in primary school myself, that was mixed age apart from year. No, it was for all of it. And yeah, never really kind of appreciated or realized just how difficult that those teachers must have been working. I mean, you'll appreciate the answer to this one, Kieran. By the end of it, was when we were in Key Stage 2, the answer was textbooks. It was like, get the textbooks out. And almost, you know, not teach yourself, but there was definitely sort of inputs. But then it was definitely sort of, right, input for one-year group, textbook, the answers are at the back of it, or the answer book for that textbook's at the back. So once you've done that, you know, go and sort yourself out. And again, we were fortunate that we were a small, I think there's probably about maybe 17 of us all together between the 2 year groups, which is obviously, you know, extremely manageable if you want to try and do something like that. So one of the answers, I think, is just, yeah, Kieran's favorite answer to most educational questions is that textbooks could potentially be helpful when you get to the upper year groups.
I have something to add. It's not going to help this person's situation. It's certainly not delivering any answers. But there seems to be a huge disparity between the number of like additional adults in some small schools. I did some CPD in one in the autumn term, and they were mixed age, like kind of bog standard mixed age of reception 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6. But they had a lot of additional adults because they seemed to have quite a lot of high needs funding. And that meant that they were just more bodies and you could just do a bit more, you were more flexible. And then there seemed to be some where it's just a teacher, maybe a head teacher who teaches a little bit, maybe a TA, maybe another teacher, but it's so hard to be able to suggest things when every situation is so unique. So I'd be interested to hear what kind of situation this person is in, if it is the most common, which I think is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but I might be speaking out of turn there. That's just the one that I've experienced or seen the most, or if they're in something that's a bit more complicated, because then we could maybe get the right people in for those episodes. I say we, like I'm on the TADAPE committee, but I'd be interested in listening either way.
I mean, anytime you are volunteering for episodes, Shannon, I'm going to bite your arm off. So look forward to those invitations. I mean, I worked, my first school was half formentary until maybe my second or third year. We had a rolling cycle curriculum, like you mentioned, Shannon. I don't think we ever got to see it fully through because we would be updating it or changing it as we went. So I don't really necessarily have any experience of seeing that through. But also I'm not sure if I'm sort of thinking it might be, yeah, I don't know. Maybe need to ask someone to come on who has actually seen the 2-year cycle through and seen what that happens. I mean, I like the specialist model, but I like that for everybody. Some of the schools I'm working with at the minute, I mean, Kent has lots of small schools, and some of them like split instruction. Some of them like to have every whatever class, you know, whatever the mix, together on a general theme. And so some of the things they do is they look at the connections between different areas so that, you know, where things veer off. Because I think the curriculum sort of chunks into phases, the key stages. You know, key stage one and two are almost like mirror images of each other, 3 and 4, and 5, 6. I don't know. Maybe it's not 100% accurate, but, and I'm thinking of maths as well. It could be that, you know, you are looking for those connections more readily, but it is personal preference. You know, I've seen suggestions of things like history, where instead of time periods, you look at themes. And I mean, that's really good for interleaving as well, isn't it? You know, so your themes start to drive how you go through the curriculum. So it's not necessarily that important that you haven't covered, you know, the Romans in year 4, followed by the Vikings, etc. Then you know, you're looking at, I don't know, I mean, what would you start with in year 3 and year 4? Maybe an idea of democracy, and then that comes through each of the terms. I'm taking what I read from someone else and I'm trying to put it to make sense. But I think, yes, subject by subject, it might make more sense to do certain things as well. Like gymnastics doesn't really change that much. You know, you start off with what is it, the pencil roll? And then you get closer to rolling on obstacles and things like that there. You know, I mean, you can tell my PE teaching was great. So it may even come down to a subject by subject decision as well, because you might find that it's easier to teach everyone the same thing, same time. But yeah, I think it's constantly reviewing. And if there were one answer, someone would be massively rich, particularly in the southeast of Kent. And I'm sure there are other pockets around the country where you've got small communities, but there's quite a lot of Kent, more than I imagined when I first moved over here, is just green grass and farms and stuff like that. So that sort of dictates the center of the county. I mean, Neil, one last thing before we move on from this, when you mentioned, you know, whether it was the number of pupils, you know, with your typical unassuming but controversial style, the number of pupils might be a good trade-off in terms of ease of workload. And maybe I've misinterpreted you, but I'm thinking, we always talk about how the strength of knowing a year group is what makes teachers really effective. And we always talk about how, yeah, do 3 years in this year, 3 years in that. You would need to be a pretty experienced teacher, even with a 3-4 split or a 1-2 split. So the jury is out on that one, I think. I don't know. I mean, I'll give you, obviously, you've got a chance to respond if I have misinterpreted you. But I do think I stand by the idea that it's more difficult, no matter what the split is, to teach in a mixed age class.
Not in the sense that it's, you know, I don't want people to take away from what I said that it's more difficult, or some people have it easy, just whether or not there is a general correlation there. If you were to plot number of pupils in a class, when I say class, I mean physical, you know, four wall mm-hmm. sort of class, against whether they were mixed age and then the range of mixed age. I can certainly see how, you know, three and four, how like a split year group of just 2 year groups probably does have 30, but it'd be quite interesting to see if that then sort of tapers on by the time you get to 3 year groups within one class, 4 year groups within one class. And I know research does tend to suggest that class size doesn't make a difference, but I don't know, ask any teacher whether they want to teach a class of 30 or a class of 20, and everyone's going to choose the 20 straight away, right? Because it may not be more impactful for the kids, but it's certainly going to make for a happier teacher, which means that the teacher will stay in mm-hmm. education longer, which means that, you know, the benefits from that, which tend not to get researched in terms of impact on these things. So yeah, definitely not saying that things are easier or harder, just wondering if there is a general interesting correlation out there on the national sort of data level. The one thing I would just kind of say, because something you mentioned about the national curriculum just reminded me about it, is that obviously just because those core subjects do have the national curriculum down into year groups, year one, year two, year three, year four, year five, doesn't mean you need to follow that. As long as you teach, the official line is, as long as you teach within the key stage, it's absolutely fine if you want to reorder those objectives however you want to. I can't believe anyone is going to notice if you leave time to the beginning of, you know, key stage two, for example, if you have a mixed age class, to make sure that everything else was, you know, in place. So important to kind of remember and know that you don't have to follow that national curriculum as is. You do have some freedom to explore that. And if you have a mixed age class, then obviously you'll want to do that.
Excellent. I mean, that was a fantastic question. There are going to be hundreds of episodes drawn from that over the next 17 years. So thank you very much to the person who sent that in. So the next one says, having a bit of a battle at my school's RE subject leader files/folders. Do your schools have them? If so, what things of value go in them? That's probably the most loaded question that's ever been asked on TADAPE. What do you reckon?
Very little. I haven't ever had a subject leader folder. I store things online. I might have like printed out things if I need them for a conversation.
In a folder?
No, in my hand. And I don't see the value of having a policy where every teacher who's a subject leader has to have a folder with their action plan, any like monitoring they've done, curriculum plans. None of that has to be printed off and put in a lever arch file. It just doesn't have to happen. Ofsted, just to throw them into the mix, will not expect to see a subject leader folder in a deep dive. I think plenty of heads or leaders might tell their subject leaders they need to have it ready for Ofsted. But Ofsted will only look at what you mention to them. So if you say, we have medium-term plans, they'll say, oh, great, what do they look like? Can I have a look? Or if you say, oh, we follow this curriculum, they'll say, can you show me evidence of that? They don't want you to get out your lever arch file and flip through all your file dividers. I know that in our school, you do not have to have one. In our trust, I don't believe we have schools that say you must have a subject leader file and it must have this. I do. It's obviously sensible to have things online and have record keeping. I'm not saying don't ever hold on to pupil voice info or when you've looked at books with teachers or pupils, I'm not saying you don't hold on to that information, because of course you do, because it builds a picture of a subject for you. But you do not need to have it all printed off in a folder to show someone, because I think that's what the folder is for. If someone is telling you you have to have a folder, it's probably not for you. It's probably for them. It's probably so they can check on it, or they think that someone's going to ask to see it. And so much better to not have a blanket rule and then build up from there. Much better to have really decent training on how to be a subject leader, put time into professional development, and then let the subject leader decide what is important to them. If you want a folder, have a folder. But there is no need to spin this lie that subject leaders have to have a folder, or, you know, they're a rubbish subject leader, or they can't possibly know what's going on in their subject without file dividers. And I also think, you know, we get lots of messages from the people who write books or are bought in to do CPD, or educational companies who have training or articles or, you know, chapters in books about being a subject leader. And there are people out there who are plugging like checklists of what a subject leader should have in a subject leader folder. And I think that's a really dangerous thing to do, because it's adding to workload. It's not directly having an impact on the quality of the teaching in that subject or the learning that the children are doing. And those are our focuses. Are the children learning? Great. Did you have a folder? Doesn't matter, because if they learn something and, you know, what you said they were going to learn is what they learn, then you're winning.
I was just thinking you'd be a really good politician, because you'd ramble on so much, not actually answer any of the question.
How offensive. I said, no, you don't need it.
Which wasn't the question. It was what value would go in.
I said very little. I answered it first.
Obviously, I agree with Shannon.
Oh, you're not having dinner tonight.
Well, exactly. I used to have to keep a folder, I'm sure, in one of the schools. It's like the NQT folders, right? Everyone says you have to keep your NQT file. I literally threw mine out very soon after completing my NQT year, because I knew no one actually keeps them or will ever look at it ever again.
I never had one.
Shannon had the foresight to never even keep one. That said, again, I am not for the forced sort of policy of you have to have one, because for some, I'm thinking about what the main sort of maths scheme that's used across the England right now, and I'm thinking, like, you don't need to have a folder for that, because so much of that is freely available online. You can find it so quickly, so easily. Like, you're literally printing things off for printing's sake. That said, if someone wanted to, absolutely fine, no harm in that whatsoever at all. Interestingly, it was like Doug Lemov who tweeted about, you know, working memory gets talked a lot about in terms of its implications for pupils. We tend not to actually talk about those implications for teachers, particularly sort of outside of a kind of a CPD perspective. So actually sort of in the classroom, or taking that one step further, in those Ofsted meetings, which are kind of high pressure, you know, we all kind of forget things under those sort of restraints. So if you think that having your external memory field, i.e. a lever arch folder or any folder, is going to help you be able to talk about that subject, then obviously, you know, you go for it and you do what you need to do. I just hope that you're just not being told what to actually have in it, because what I would want in a folder for my particular subject that I'm leading at that time may not be what is needed for the English lead, or maybe the English lead is someone of 20 years experience and can tell you exactly what the intent, implementation, and impact of English in that school is, like the back of their hand. So, you know, crack on in doing that. That said, those kind of three words, intent, implementation, and impact, if you had to have one, that kind of strikes me as a generally actually quite useful way to organize those folders. What do you intend to teach them? How are you going about teaching them? And then what impact do you have that you actually are teaching them? And I think anything more than that is, you know, unnecessary, because I remember you used to have to print off like whole school policies and stuff like that, like have the marking policy in your subject leader file and weird and wonderful stuff like that, which definitely not needed.
I think you made a really nice point about what works for the English lead might not work for the science lead, or might not be relevant for different subjects. And I think a huge problem that we have is that idea of consistency. And I think consistency should be in the quality of the teaching and the quality of the learning, not in a folder or how someone works. And consistency does not mean uniformity. Consistency should be about, are all of the children getting a good deal here in every subject? Are they all learning in every subject? Is the quality of teaching excellent in every subject? And it's a bit like, you know, I'm hoping that there aren't people listening who still have to send their planning in by 5 o'clock on a Friday for scrutiny, because that was insane. And I don't think that anyone should be checking planning until you go, oh, are the children not making progress? Do they not seem to be learning? I've done a learning walk and a teacher doesn't seem to know what's going on. You have a conversation. I'm not saying you then check planning. You have a conversation and you say, what support can we put in place to make this better or easier, or to support you with your planning and your delivery? Much like if in a certain subject you see that children aren't necessarily, I don't know, retaining information or applying their knowledge, they're not able to score well on an end of unit quiz for some reason, then you might have a conversation and say, okay, talk to me about your subject, talk to me about what the pupils say, what do the teachers say, what have you seen in lessons. That doesn't need to be in a folder. If someone is making you have a folder for whatever reason, my first piece of advice would be send them this podcast. My second piece of advice would be, like Neil said, keep it bare minimum. Think about the things that are going to be helpful to you to have on hand, if that's a thing. So having things like notes of conversations you've had with the pupils, great. Examples of really nice practice that you've seen, either from a conversation with a teacher in a book, or a child with their book, or in a lesson, things that you might want to draw on when you have a conversation with someone. We had an Ofsted inspection before the summer holidays. I'm the curriculum lead in my school, and you know, I didn't go in with a folder of pre-prepared things. I went in with some sheets of paper in my hand and the subject leaders, who one had a folder, one didn't. So, you know, and they both did very well. And I just had a few things in my hand that I thought were important to show. So I had our curriculum implementation plan that I stole from Lloyd Williams Jones. And I had our kind of curriculum vision that we'd been working on. And I had a document that's a bit like a web of connections and where we draw on meaningful connections in those subjects to show that we had thought deeply about our curriculum. But that wasn't in a folder. That was me just printing them off before I went in for a conversation. And I think that suffices. I could have had my laptop, but the internet in our school is very dodgy and you never know if it's going to cut out. So I printed them off before I went in there. That's all you need.
I think it's important to let listeners know that you actually followed the plan from Lloyd Williams Jones. You didn't just ask him the night before for a random curriculum plan to show that you were, you know, here's a curriculum plan. So
I didn't even think that's how it'd be interpreted. Welsh. But now you've said it, I realise. Yes, we had been working on it for over a year, and then I had it that I'd updated, and oh wow, thank you for that.
Three questions: one sent via email, one sent via Twitter, one on the Discord. I think you guys have done an excellent job of giving your opinions based on limited sight of what was coming your way. And so, yeah, and like I said, I think we've got lots of ideas for future episodes, but hopefully that's easy to everyone into 2024. And I would encourage you to go back and check out Shannon's last appearance just before, it was on Christmas, wasn't it? Saturday before Christmas, where we talked about maths and engaging parents and carers at home. And also the Chris Such 9 Misconceptions Surrounding the Teaching of Phonics, which Neil, you are yet to retort to. And we're looking forward to that episode coming up in the near future. But yeah.
As am I.
That was sinister. Yeah. But yeah, thank you very much to everyone who sent in the questions. If you were incensed by anything that Neil has said, please let us know in the comments. In 2024, Google are getting rid of Google Podcasts, so we've had to move the podcast onto YouTube. I mean, 80% of listenership is Apple Podcasts, and maybe 17% is Spotify. So you're talking small market share. This is probably why Google have got rid of Google Podcasts. But just to give anyone who listens on that platform a heads up that we've transferred the RSS feed, and so every Saturday we're on YouTube all automatically. But it's just the audio, no video for some reason. I suppose it's probably because it's an RSS feed, and that's the way it works. All that's left to do is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you, as always.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.